Good morning. Okay, let me try that again. Good morning, everyone. Woohoo! Excellent. My name is Hannah Grove. I'm CMO of State Street. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here today, even though my voice isn't exactly there. And I'm really excited to introduce this topic because we all have heard of EQ and we've heard of IQ, but there's actually another really powerful tool of advancement that's CQ, or contextual intelligence. Now, I think every one of us at various times in our lives have been told we need to network, we need to get out there, we need to make connections. In fact, I think for many of us, and certainly my 18-year-old daughter, self-worth is rated by the number of Facebook connections, Twitter followers, Pinterest, Instagram. But in fact, here's a spoiler alert and something that I feel very passionately about. Digital will never take the place of real human interaction. Right?
Please.
So, when it comes to connections, our leader of this session, Erica Dewan, she doesn't subscribe to the theory that more is necessarily better. In fact, her view is that success isn't defined by the number of your connections. It's really how are you tapping into those connections and really bringing groups together to bring insights and powerful ideas. And that can happen at the coffee shop, it can happen over lunch, it can happen in meetings, and it can absolutely happen in places like this. Erica is CEO of her firm, Contentional. She's a leading expert on millennials in the workforce. She's spoken at the World Economic Forum. Her work has been published in the Harvard Review and Forbes, to name but a few. She's also the co-author of Get Big Things Done, The Power of Contextual Intelligence. And she's going to enlighten us about what that's all about. So please welcome Erica, who's going to lead our panel and introduce them, and then I'll come up at the end to help facilitate a Q&A. So over to you, Erica.
Thank you.
Welcome. Let's get big things done. Thank you for being here. Thank you, Hannah, for that great introduction. As was mentioned, my name is Erica Dewan, and my mission is to help us create a more connectionally intelligent world. I've spent the last decade studying the number one key skill that I believe is critical in our hyper-connected era. And today, what we're going to do is help you learn not only what connectional intelligence is, but how you can use it to supercharge your leadership, how you can get big things done by tapping into all of the networks that you have access to, and we'll also get a unique opportunity to hear from two panelist experts, Dr. Jen Welter and Christine Frazier, about how they've used connectional intelligence in their life. But before we dive right in, I realize that in order to really practice what we preach, let's get connected in this room. So I thought to myself, how can we get connected in this room in a new, fun way? One of my personal passions is dance. Who here likes to dance? So to warm up the room, I would like everyone to stand up right now. And I'm going to walk you through a short dance move. So we're going to put our arms up, and we're just going to shake it out. Here we go. Don't we need to start every meeting like that? Yes, that's what women can do. Right. All right, now I'm out of breath, so I need a minute. Whew. All right. In today's era of disruption, the most under-leveraged asset is the intelligence within our own organizations. A few years ago, a key executive at Colgate-Palmolive had a scientific challenge. His team had developed a new fluoride that they were meshing in their toothpaste. But there was a mechanical flow problem, and the fluoride was getting stuck in the equipment. It wasn't meshing well, and all the best chemists internally were trying to figure out why. No one could. It was taking months and months of time and costing hundreds of thousands of dollars. So at that point, the executive said, well, why don't we ask a different network? And they ended up posting this fluoride challenge on a website called Innocentive, which is a crowdsourcing community for scientists. Within 2 days of posting this fluoride challenge, a physicist named Ed Melkrick looked at the problem and he said, this isn't a chemistry problem, it's a physics problem. It's about charged particles. You charge a fluoride one way, toothpaste the other, instantly the problem was solved. Colgate learned a few things from this experience. The first thing they learned is that they didn't even dare to ask the physicists at their own company because they labeled it as a chemistry problem. The second thing they realized is that physicists would have never been hired by Colgate. He didn't have the traditional resume. He had had odd jobs throughout his life. And in today's world, they could access and engage networks far outside their traditional expertise networks. The first question I want you all to think about is, how do you keep learning and leveraging networks outside of your own? Networks outside of who you always ask. And as you think about the future, how can you design your questions to engage those outside of who you typically ask on regular topics? A few years ago, another story I want to share is from a law firm. The CFO of the law firm noticed something peculiar happening. He noticed that the youngest associates at the firm, the millennial associates, were billing less hours than ever before. Now, this was odd because they were giving them more work, not less work, and as we all know, law firms bill by the hour, so it was actually a concern. So when they dug into it, they realized that these associates had created their own peer-to-peer Twitter-type network to help each other solve cases faster. Questions such as, where's this legal citation? Or have we done this before? I know we did this in law school. What was the name of it? Where could I find it? And it became such a rapidly productive community, it was dropping the billing hours of the business. So on one end, the executive team said, well, now we can give them more work, not less work, which we know lawyers love. On the other end, they realized these associates get promoted through billing hours, and they're choosing to work in this more productive way. Now the law firm has actually implemented a whole Twitter at work initiative, which leverages the power of peer groups across practices, across offices, to tap into that internal knowledge sharing. So as we think about the future, not only is it about tapping into unique networks, but understanding that one of the key values we can bring is not having the answer, it's learning how to find the answer and learning how to leverage others outside of our traditional teams to discover new solutions. The last quick story I want to share is about the creation of the Doritos guacamole chip. And besides being a great product that's delicious, it was created in a very unique way at Frito-Lay. So when you think about a product like a guacamole-flavored chip, which business unit would develop it? Just shout it out. What do you think? Marketing, R&D. It didn't come from any of those networks. It came from a different network. Keep guessing. Not clients, not customers. Keep going. It came from the Latino Employee Resource Network at Frito-Lay that when combined as a group, just like a room like this one, realized that as a diverse group, they were asking different questions. And one of the questions that was obvious to them is, why don't we have a Doritos chip that effectively targets the Latino customer segment? They came up with a bunch of ideas. One of them was a guacamole chip. The guacamole chip ended up being a $100 million product for Frito-Lay. Then the Asian network said, hey, we want to do this too. They came up with a curry chip that was a bestseller across Asia. And now annually, Frito-Lay brings together all the different diversity networks to come up with product ideas every year. So if we think about all the networks we're a part of, we often ask ourselves, what purpose do they offer now for us? But have we asked ourselves, what other problems could they solve? And how could we engage them in a very different way outside of what they're usually the go-to for to drive greater change in our workplaces and in our lives? If you think about these three stories, you may think, you know, where are we today? In our connected world, it's not just about the individual, and it's not just about the institution, it's about the collective. It's about making anyone in the world accountable. And the job of 20th century leaders were those that were able to spread accountability within their team or their business unit. But the job of 21st century leaders will be those that will be able to spread accountability much farther to networks of those unique peer groups, to that one-off physicist that might have the answer by engaging them to the unique network of diverse talent within a company at Frito-Lay. So what we're going to do today is talk about how do we spread accountability? How do we leverage the networks that we have to truly drive change and not get overwhelmed by the overconnectedness that we face? And the answer to that is through a key skill that I call connectional intelligence. Connectional intelligence is the capability to drive breakthrough innovation and business results by fully harnessing the power of our networks and relationships. Just as we know IQ and EQ that came about in the 90s, in today's teams that are virtual, global, multi-generational, matrix, we can't just rely on EQ when we're not in a room with one another, when we're leveraging stakeholders of all kinds. We need to understand the skill of leveraging networks in new ways. And underneath connectional intelligence, there are a few key tenets. The first tenet is the most important skill you need is not having the answer, it's understanding how to find the answer. The second key tenet is it's not about asking a lot of questions, it's about designing your questions to engage those outside of who you traditionally reach out to. And the third key tenet is that the best ideas can come from anywhere, regardless of title, level, expertise, and beyond. 10 years ago, Malcolm Gladwell coined the concept of a connector. Some of you may have heard of it in his book, The Tipping Point. And that idea was revolutionary 10 years ago. But in today's world, I'd argue that it's outdated because we are not connected, we are over-connected. The average employee spends 16 hours a week on their email inbox. Worse, only 27% of that time is productive to the day-to-day emails. $30 billion in salary cost is wasted every year in unproductive meetings. The average executive has 30,000 emails in their inbox every year. So we are not just connected, we are over-connected. So the question now is not how do we connect more, how do we create more followers, it's how do we leverage and connect intelligently in our overconnected era? And in our research and in my book, Get Big Things Done, what we discovered is that there are actually three types of connectors today that you need to leverage to better tap into the intelligence of connections. The three types of connectors are thinkers, enablers, and executors. So thinkers are your big idea connectors. These are the people that understand how to connect through ideas. This is the Colgate executive that said, well, why don't we solve this in a new and different way and ask a different network? Even though he didn't have the social media tools, he didn't have the network on hand, he knew how to ask different questions. The second type of connector are the enablers. These are the people that understand how to build the structures and forces and mobilize people together. So they know, they're that person that knows all the right other people that need to come together to get something done. So if you think about at Frito-Lay, the Latino network, realizing that they were a unique network of enablers, not only of diversity and inclusion, but of product innovation. And the third type of connectors are the executors. Think of these as the law firm associates that are mobilizing and collaborating in action using social networks, using digital technology. We hold all parts of these styles within ourselves, thinkers, enablers, and executors. But what we really need to understand now is that we all collaborate differently. And what we can do is leverage each other's strengths to get big things done in today's era. So thinkers may be able to bring that new approach to a meeting. Enablers may be able to find the right people, and executors can help you accelerate it. What I want to do now, before we dive into our esteemed panel with a few experts and leaders in their field, is share what I call the three tips in activating connectional intelligence. The first is called declaring war on inefficiencies. So as I shared, we're not just connected, we're over-connected. And actually, in order to better leverage our relationships, we have to kill all the inefficiency and waste we experience. I'll give you an example. A few years ago at Sprint, they realized that they had a lot of inefficient meetings. Anyone had those before? So they launched an initiative called Kill Stupid Meetings, where over a year, they analyzed every single meeting, and employees could rate the meeting. Should we kill it? Should we improve it? Or should we keep it? And you couldn't just, you know, just kill it. You had to give reasons of what was the value we received. Was this a good use of time? Are we leveraging each other in the right way? And they were able to reduce up to 30% of meetings in the company culture. What they found is that killing meetings actually allowed them to be more collaborative because they had time to talk to each other instead of a meeting where one person presented and everyone listened. Another example of this is Accenture, who realized that they couldn't kill meetings, But they had to create new ways to change culture. So they realized that they had a lot of fear and guilt where people felt they had to come to the meeting or else someone would think something different of them. So they created a campaign called the Just Say No campaign, where if there wasn't a very clear reason, they could just say no and use that time more effectively. A last quick example around declaring war on inefficiencies is from Google. So Google did something a few years ago where they created cut the crap committees because they realized there were so many bureaucracies in the culture that were getting in the way of real human connections. What happened is people would share a procedure or a process that was inefficient, and you couldn't just complain. You would have to come up with a better rule or process. So oftentimes, approvals that involved 10 people turned into 2 people. There were ways that things were able to get done, not in 6 months, but actually 2 days because of the way the exchanges happened. Guess who had the best ideas in the cut the crop committees? Anyone want to guess? Not just women, but there was another group, but of course women. Administrative assistants. No one had ever asked them for their ideas, and they had the best ideas around how to kill bureaucracy. So on one end, it's really about killing those inefficiencies first. The next step is how do you then, once you have this time back that we've lost in our digitally connected era, it's really about designing ways to leverage connectional intelligence effectively. I'll give you one final story here, and this is about the Oreo tweet at Super Bowl 2013. So at Super Bowl 2013, besides Beyonce performing, which is what I remember, right, there was a blackout, and it lasted 46 minutes of the game. During that blackout, within 4 minutes of the blackout game, Oreo, the brand, dived into action. They launched an ad that said, "Power out, no problem, you can still dunk your Oreos in the dark." And they put it on Twitter within 4 minutes of the blackout. This ad went absolutely viral, 20,000 retweets, 15,000 Facebook likes. It was dubbed the best ad at Super Bowl 2013, beating every multi-million dollar commercial made in 4 minutes and entirely free, including Oreo having a 30-second commercial the game that didn't do nearly as well. So how are they able to do this? This wasn't luck. They had designed for connectional intelligence. From 2 years before that game, they created a cross-functional SWAT team of lawyers, of the ad agency, the executives, all coming together to practice launching real-time ads around relevant news. And they did this on a monthly basis. And it was because they had built the muscle of collaborative trust, for 2 years they were able to launch that real-time ad that virtually every brand has tried to model over the last few years. So these are some of the unimaginable changes that we're facing. We have this rise of unnecessary meetings, emails, dysfunction, and delays in our teams and working and trying to be collaborative. At the same time, what we need to do is break free from that, tap into understanding our different collaborative skills and designing for connectional intelligence. So what I want to do now is bring us to our esteemed panel. We're going to hear from two leading experts who not only are leaders in their field, but have practiced connectional intelligence. I want to introduce them really quick, and then we're going to ask a few questions, and we're going to do a lot of Q&A in this room. So what I'd encourage you to do is write down your questions, think about what you may want to ask, and we also have mics throughout the room as well. Our first panelist is Dr. Jen Welter, who became the first female coach in the NFL when she joined the Arizona Cardinals as a linebacker coach in the summer of 2015. There's more. I have more. She's also the first woman to play running back in a men's professional football league and the first to coach men's professional football, helping to lead the Texan Revolution through the most successful season in franchise history. There's so much more I can say about her. She's the author of Play Big. She's been recognized by the United Nations as Sports Pioneer of the Year, and ESPNW named her one of the most 25 most influential women in sports in 2015. So round of applause for having an amazing guest here. And we also have another esteemed guest, Christine Frazier, who is the Senior Vice President of Strategy and Operations for Dell EMC Services and IT as part of recently formed Dell Technologies.
People are just used to clapping.
I'm really good with it. It's not as impressive as Ben. It's okay.
I want to share a few more things about Christine. She serves as the executive sponsor of Dell's EMC Women of Color Board. She's been an advocate for women.
A lot of the
support of STEM. And so we're going to dive right into this panel. So what I'd love to do first is share, how have you seen connectional intelligence being used in your lives? Where have you had moments where you've leveraged your networks, and how have they changed the course of your career?
Good. I got the most applause. You know, to me, I think connection starts with something that a lot of people forget, and that's listening. A lot of people want to go into a situation and command respect. That was the biggest question I got when I was going into the Cardinals, is how did you make the players listen to you? And I didn't. I listened to them first. Because anytime you're going into a situation, the thing that most people lose is what's really going on. How can I tell you how I'm going to coach you if I don't know what the current situation is, right? And for somebody who was completely an outsider, I was completely objective, because what I could do is watch, listen, and then jump in where I could actually help, as opposed to saying, well, this is the kind of coach I was going to be. Well, guess what? The closest I had really ever been to an NFL sidelines before when I got there was the nosebleed section. Okay? We couldn't afford it. And second of all, there was no place in the NFL that I could look at and say, I want to be her when I grow up. So there was nobody I could say I wanted to coach like her. So what I did is invest in the most important capital, and that's what it is human capital. And I knew that all of those players were very real people. And so my job as a coach was to help them and to connect with them. And to me, that's the most intelligent connection, is the human one. And then when you know what's going on, what you can do is then further connect. And I'll give you an example that doesn't have a whole lot of research, except that it works. Is the fact that, you know, some of the best moments that I would have with those guys in the hallway, because they'd never had anybody like me to talk to before. Maybe it was because I was a woman, maybe a player that they didn't have to compete with because, you know, I was only about at their belly button, or, you know, the fact that I had a doctorate in psychology, right? And so much of what's missed every day in work and is unproductive is stuff that goes on outside of work. And if you don't know your people well enough, guess what? You don't know the difference of why they're just not off, or they're just not right that day. And my players would come up to me all the time, and it was like you were like their little secret weapon. I'd be like, yo, Coach Den, you got a minute? Yeah, what's up? Coach, my wife is so mad at me. Yeah. And I don't even know what I did. And I would tell them, I am an expert in male-to-female translation. Let's talk.
There you go. Let's give a round of applause. Jen, you model what true feminine leadership is, and one of the most powerful traits of connected leaders of today's age. Christine, tell us, how have you used connectional intelligence in your life?
Yeah, I think part of it is what Jen hit on, which for me is sort of core to how I operate anyway, and that is relationships are really, really important to me. And I think So Jen is in a work environment that is clearly male dominated. Yeah. maybe you know, IT is.
We're in the same game.
Similar profile of men outnumber women by large factors. And you know, having a voice in that conversation can be challenging unless you bring something very authentic to the equation. And I think relationships, for me, it has been largely about having a really clear and defined purpose that others feel attached to. So, you know, it's one thing, I tell people that work on my team, if you're leading and you turn around and no one is behind you, you're probably not going to be successful. And so connectedness, it is, you know, there's a digital aspect of it, but it really is the relationship piece and getting people to rally around a common goal that they feel energized and enthusiastic about, and they see themselves in part of the solution to that problem.
Yeah. And I'll build on that with what you said. To me, it's funny because I talk about authenticity. Okay, and you hear it a lot of times. They're like, be an authentic leader. But it's like they drop the mic at that, and it's like they're coaching you up in a fortune cookie. Like, you will be an authentic leader. And you're like, ah. Nobody knows what that means. It's kind of like,
Yeah.
What does that mean? And yet, when I went into the NFL, one of my mentors, who is actually a former New England Patriot and unfortunately recently passed away, but Terry Glenn, he pulled me aside one morning, and he was a guy who didn't say much, so everything he said spoke volumes. And he said, the very best advice I can give you before going into the NFL is to be 100% authentic. He said, if you are the same person that you were here with us every day, those guys will absolutely love you. But if you're fake in any way, they will sense it, and they will eat you alive. And so in a place where there was nobody I could model my behavior on, those were the words I kept to the core of my spirit, is to just be uniquely me, because they didn't need another one of those guys at the table. And it wasn't that there was anything wrong with those guys, but they needed a different voice. And if I tried to be them, no offense, I don't believe that women to lead in a man's world, or to win in the boys' club, as I always say, means that you should be a man in the process. I was never going to outman a man at being a man, and frankly, that was not my job.
Yeah.
Okay? My job was to be willing to be that authentic voice, and that was the strength. And I think each one of you has this unique gift, and when we miss that in organizations, it's because you tried to have someone else's voice, or you were afraid to use your own. So.
Yeah.
And what I'm hearing you say, Jen, is voice can come in different ways. And in many ways, my personal story as an Indian American girl who was quiet as a kid and now speaking, I not only use that dancing technique today, I dance in every single one of my sessions as a starter of a group session. And what I realize is that our bodies also reach for words that don't exist. And we can create new languages just by creating spaces for people to be vulnerable and open up in new ways. So you are the author of Play Big. So you're all about playing big. What advice do you have for the women in this room when they face an obstacle? What are the things that you told yourself?
First of all, that's life.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's not a gender-assigned thing. Okay? We all face obstacles in life. One thing I love about football is it taught me it's not a question of when you get hit, it's when. And your choice is how you get back up. Okay? There's really no, to me, it's not about quitting. It's about learning how to get back up and to do it with attitude. Because those things are the things that will define you. The easy stuff doesn't change lives. It doesn't change your life. It doesn't change anybody else's. It's like you said, if you're leading and nobody's following, you're not really leading. You're kind of walking around in circles, probably by yourself. Okay? You have to be willing to dig into what you see as an obstacle and realize that it's an opportunity. Because if everybody always saw things as easy, nothing would change. So when you see an obstacle, realize you're actually learning what it takes to win. Okay? Because those barriers to entry are also opportunities for growth and development. So kind of do what I do, and I'm like, you know, and my philosophy when I played was, okay, I'm 5'2", 130 pounds. I was never the one that anybody would look at and say, oh my gosh, you're going to be one of the best football players in the world. Kind of never happened. And when I first started playing football, it was really, like, unfortunate because I thought I had to be big like everybody else. So I would, like, run high, and it was like I was trying to get up to 5'3". And... You know, we have a saying in football, if you're high, you fly. You have no leverage. So you get knocked down easily if you're not in your proper stance, which is low. And when I realized that I couldn't outbig anybody, but I could outlittle them and outquick them and frankly outcute them, because that really ticked everybody off. And so I started owning that I was little and cute, and I even started playing in makeup and in pigtails, and then
love it.
I became a master of my own career. And so really you have to define your game and don't play anybody else's.
I think there's two, you know, I think women just tend to over-focus on the obstacle. And I think that, you know, we are the problem solvers of the world. You know, whether you're doing that at work, or you're doing it for your family, or doing it for your parents, culture looks to us to solve the problems. And I think, my sister's here today, and we grew up, there are five children in our family, two daughters and three sons. All of us are math or engineering majors. And, I became a math major because my sister was a math major. I had no idea what the heck I was doing, except that I knew I was really good at math. And, in our household, we were told, like, if someone else can get an A, you can get an A. And so I never really gave a lot of life to obstacles. And I'm very fortunate to work with some of the younger women of color, I mentor a lot of young women, or even mid-career women. And, I tell them, don't give power to the thing that others want to put in front of you as your obstacle, whether that's your gender, your ethnicity, your socioeconomic background, your marital status, whatever it is that you feel someone is passing a judgment on you and putting that obstacle in front of you as a reason that you can't do something. Like, don't give power to it. Be who you are. We are the problem solvers of the world. And I think we need to spend a lot less time on the obstacles and the mental, exercises that we have in our brain about what we can't do. And just celebrate what you're doing every single day. Don't give power to the obstacles.
It's funny what you said. Reminds me of when I was the head coach of Team Australia. Okay. And they love the game of football, but they had not really had somebody teach them. They were teaching themselves off of YouTube and a lot. So a lot of the drills they were doing and their technique, a lot of the times, was really pretty good. And it looked pretty good until we put them in an actual live scrimmage. And I was watching my girls on defense, and they were, going to the blockers. And I'm like, and I'm watching. And I'm watching, and I'm like, you know how to get past them. We have a rib move, we have a swim move, we have all these tools to get past these blockers, and they're not using any of them. And I'm kind of like, okay, I could rip through anything in my career, right? And I asked one of the girls, and I said, well, it was almost like you ran to the blocker, why didn't you just go past her? And she said, Coach, that's what it looks like on the paper. And on the play sheet, it literally had the blocker come out to the defender, and she just stopped where it was on the paper. And I think that is so much what you talk about, contextual intelligence and how it's always been written up. Like, if you studied a playbook that just showed you where to go to and how not to go past it, why would you go any further? Okay? So don't focus on that end. Focus on where you're really trying to go, which is get through it in the end.
What I'm really hearing is that the most important conversations we have are the ones we have with ourselves. And listening is not only outward, but inward, to make sure that we're really manifesting who we really are. But
well, and it's gaining the assets that you have around you, and you can't do that with the ego. That means that you know the questions before that they've been asked, right? Like, if you're not talking to and tapping into the people around you, and knowing not just what they do, but who they are and how they think, you're missing your greatest assets. You're not problem solving if you don't know the people that you're really in the trenches with. You need to know the people who can translate past what's on a job description.
I'll give you an example. I just had a conversation recently with a very senior woman executive who has gone through a fairly difficult transition in her career, and we were talking, and she said, you know, the one thing I've realized, she's had some time to reflect on the situation, and she said, you know, the thing that I realized that was my biggest issue was I didn't ask for help, or I didn't accept the help when it was offered. And, you know, help is a very generic term. To Jen's point, you have to have sort of this network of people around you that you're maybe not interacting with them every day, but they're your go-to people for fill in the blank. You know, they're your go-to person for technology. They're your go-to person for career advice. They're your go-to person for financial advice, whatever it is. But, you know, none of us are in a position to do everything. And I think that's another, you know, myth you should dispel as quickly as you can in your career. No one gets anywhere by themselves. It is a myth. And if you think about the leaders that you respect the most, you probably can identify their prodigies or the people that are modeling their behavior every day because they've built large networks around them, and you just don't get anywhere on your own.
Yeah. And get to know them, right? Like, I remember when I first got out of the NFL, it's like when you're the first, nobody really knows what to do with you. They're kind of like, oh, that's cool. But I had a lot of people who would say, if you ever need any help, just let me know. And I'd be like, oh, okay, cool. Now, I didn't know enough to at that point do what I always do now, is be like, no, let me know how, because I don't know enough about you to know what your special sauce is that you could bring to the equation. So as you meet somebody, if they want to get involved in your career or you want to network, be willing to say, like, awesome, okay, so, like, you want to help me, how can you help me? And they would say, well, what do you need? And I'd be like, I don't know what you do. Right, you know what I do, I coach football. Well, that's one element of who I am. There's a whole lot of other ways I could help you, right? So I would say, well, I have a doctorate in psychology, I'm a really good listener, and actually I'm kind of a professional at that, right? And so if you don't have those conversations, you'll never know where that true interconnection can have. So don't just say, oh, if I can ever help you, like, please let me know. No, be like, okay, awesome. If you could design how you could help me in my life and you were gonna come in and be like my fairy godmother, what would your title be, right? So,
practical and actionable, things that we always face. What I want to do is leverage some of the connectional intelligence in this room so that we can have a really powerful Q&A. What I'd like you to do is talk to a partner sitting next to you and think of one insight you're gaining and one question you may have. We'll give you about 3 to 4 minutes for this. And then if you have a question or a comment, I really want to encourage you to come to the mics so that we can hear some of your questions, ask the panelists things that are top of mind for you, and share insights.
And if you have one burning right now, just go ahead and step up on the mic.
Yes, and if you have one burning, go ahead. Take about 2 minutes, 2 to 3 minutes for this, and then we'll get some people to the mic. You guys are great.
Huh?
You guys are amazing. I do this because it helps get people to the mic.
What's that? What's that? Where are you doing?
Hi, my name is Bobby Carlton. I run Innovation Women, which is a speakers bureau for entrepreneurial and technical women. And I'm curious if the three of you use technology tools to connect with large groups like this, and what those are, and what suggestions you might have.
Well, I think the obvious, right? Like, there are so many social platforms. Maybe narrowing the question down a little bit, what are the ones that are most effective, maybe, in a professional environment? I'll take that bend on it. I think one of the things that is enormously important about digital connections are that they are the great equalizer. So, and what I mean by that is, how many people go to YouTube to figure out how to do something? Do you know the person that you're now entrusting to guide you to install an electric socket? Like, no. But you watch and you see and you're like, God, that person had a lot to offer me. How many people shop on Amazon and go down to the ratings to decide which version of the product you're going to buy, right? Digitization is the great equalizer. It eliminates gender bias. It eliminates any kind of bias that you have to listening to someone before when you see them. And so for me, I value the access to information that I can get through a digital platform, and I don't limit it to the people that I know. So that is how I have been able to use it in different ways than just my physical network of people.
Yeah. I'm going to take a little bit different answer. Yes, it's an important way to communicate, right? So if you want to communicate with me, Instagram, Welter47. Okay, athletes were simple. It's last name and number. You could probably all hack the code if you just go for our last name and
password
number.
Password too.
Right. No. That one I'm better about, but you'll find them. JenWelter.com, real simple. LinkedIn, same thing, Dr. Jen Welter, I think. And then Twitter is at JWelter47. And I try and be as responsive as possible. And one of the things that I would tell all of you is, yes, it's an equalizer, but it's not equal. It's not equal male to female, because females are not as good at retweeting, supporting, and sharing powerful stories of innovation and change as men are, okay? And they will actually do that more, which is a little bit scary. Women will share more family-oriented stuff and less of a voice in, technology and some of those things. So you need to pick the stories that are powerful, and if anything has taught us this, like the presidency now, you need to make sure that the stories that you're sharing have the power to change a generation, because now it doesn't have to be filtered through the media. It can come from your voices. So select those stories wisely and use your collective voice to change the dialogue.
Yeah, I think the one thing I'll add to that is understand for yourself where you find your voice. So you may be an introvert, and instead of going to meetings, you find that you can grow your voice through Twitter or LinkedIn. Or you may be a techie, right? And you may be on sites like Quora or Stack Overflow. So it starts with understanding where do you find your voice? And just, I say, choose three. You don't need to be on 10 million sites. And also, as I talked about the thinkers, enablers, and executors, you don't have to always use social media. Sometimes maybe you find your voice in rooms with others, engaging others in small groups, just like community organizers, just like we need. And Facebook likes doesn't necessarily mean social change, right? And corporate change. It really is an activator and awareness tool. Let's go to the next question.
Hi, my name is Abby Pinchon. I am a buyer at Macy's, and I'm a year and a half out of college. And I was just wondering if any of you have any advice for navigating my core beliefs as a feminist and working in a male-dominated field. By a lot of older generations, we're told that politics don't really have a place in the workplace, and at a time when being a feminist is kind of a huge political statement, which in my opinion is a little ridiculous, but when it is a huge political statement, I'm struggling kind of with what's appropriate to talk about at work with my colleagues.
I think in anything, it's really, first of all, knowing the people who share and resonate your beliefs, okay? If you're going to be yelling at a wall and it's not absorbed, it's just going to wear your voice out, okay? So you have to find your place and your way where you have people who support and have those conversations with you. I would not have necessarily... I would never have gone in and said, like, that I was a feminist in being in the NFL. I didn't have to. Me being there was a feminist statement.
Yeah.
I, like, I didn't have to say, I'm for women. Clearly, there's one woman on the sidelines. That says more than anything I could have ever screamed at the top of my lungs. So realize that you being good and great is already saying something. You being there is changing the culture. So don't feel trapped that if you're not putting your hand up and screaming at the top of a mountain, that you're not creating change. You'll know when to speak up, when to own that voice, and when to, first and foremost, be great at your job in a place that you're happy to work. Because if you're not valued there, you don't need to be there. Because there's a million places where you will be.
The tech field is, as I mentioned earlier, you know, has been dominated by men, and in fact, you know, to be even more narrow, more white men. I get asked a lot. I mean, I would tell you that for a long time, I have been the only woman in a lot of meetings, and it's definitely changing. But you know, I think that. You have to consider what's really happening in the work environment and what is your role. Your role, first and foremost, in your work environment is to do your job. Your role is to do that with integrity, to do that with, to do it authentically, to do that in a way that's collaborative and productive. It's not necessarily your role to provide an educational experience for everybody on whatever your beliefs are, whether they are, you know, feminist beliefs or whether they are religious beliefs or whether they're political beliefs. And in fact, you know, I'm sure everybody can relate to the fact that it's very difficult right now to talk about politics in the work environment because you really don't know, you know, what people's ideas are. So I would just tell you, this is, and I always say this is one person's view of the world, I think you have to be authentic with who you are. And if you're in an environment that doesn't value you for your contribution, and that ascribes some limitations to that based on your gender, you're in the wrong place. And you know, some people feel as if it's our job to change everything. I do feel that we have responsibility. I personally feel very, very fortunate for the career that I've had, and I have a very strong commitment to other women. But if the environment is toxic, you sort of have to ask yourself, how much can you change, and how much are you really, you know, willing to change? Or is there another place that's more aligned to your beliefs and your values?
Yeah, great. Go to the next question here.
Hi, my name's Ariel Harris. I work on a project management team at State Street. And, you know, I feel as though I've read Get Big Things Done. I've really taken responsibility in my own career for networking and getting those different relationships so that I can ensure success in areas that I'm not as knowledgeable in. And, you know, bring all that together to make one thing happen, get our big projects done. There's so many other people, though, that I've either mentored or work on teams with me that have a really hard time doing that. Even sending an email to someone that, you know, someone else put them in touch with them, hey, send this person an email, they can help you, or go to this networking event. How do you coach all these different, especially women, through having the power to go up to someone, introduce themselves, ask for help, go to those events, send those emails?
I would say it all starts with, what are you most passionate about? And engaging a network around what you care most about. So if that's painting, start a painting class and a group to paint on weekends and build a network. If that's talking about feminist issues in the workplace, if that's reading books and joining a book club, honestly, our greatest sources of help are almost often where we least expect them. And so, you know, as we think about building a network and going out there, yes, it's about confidence and it's about listening and curiosity, but it's also about understanding from ourselves, where do we connect most? Because from that place, it's much easier to relate and forge ties with others.
If you find it really easy to do that yourself, then, you know, create environments where other women or people can, you know, can be around senior people and break those barriers. We have a program where I bring executives into my home, and I bring a lot of early career professionals, and you know, that's like they're really perplexed by why are they getting invited to someone's house. Initially, but what you realize was when you're in a physical setting outside of work, like, you know, everybody pulls their pants on the same way, and so creating experiences where you can destigmatize that divide is really helpful. But you know, lead by example, show other people. I have a young professional who just came to see me the other day who I connected to a couple of executives, and he said to me, you know, after like the first 15 minutes, like we had a lot to talk about. And I said, yeah, like pretty much everyone's the same. We're all humans. But, you know, it's sort of like you have to do it one or two times to feel confident that, you know, you're going to be successful at it.
My name is Flor. Excuse me. My name is Florcy. I'm with Dell Technologies. My question actually was interesting enough. I sourced it part of the Women of Color. Like, hey, we should ask a great question. And my question is for Chris. I'd love for you to share how you've been making connectional intelligence in the workplace with women of color.
So it's a loaded question because Florcy's on the board. and there's several board members. Look, just to be really brief, and I'll be, you know, people who know me, I'm very direct and I'm very transparent. I'm very close to a woman who was a chief diversity officer at EMC before we did the merger, Jackie Glenn, who many of you may have seen last night because she did the introduction. A little bit before the election last year, Jackie and I were talking just about how difficult it was, the environment had become for young professionals of color. EMC had a program at the time where we did a lot of recruiting from southern schools, traditionally black schools, because we had a real commitment to diversifying our population of young professionals. And so we had, you know, maybe 20 or 40, I call them kids because they're the same age as my children, but we had these young professionals who largely had come from outside of Boston. You know, they were from, they had left their families behind, they had left pretty much their whole support system, their network system behind, and they were now plopped down in the middle of Boston or in the middle of Providence working in Hopkinton. And if you're from Massachusetts, you know Hopkinton is in the suburbs. It's nowhere close to Boston. And, you know, it just really wasn't the most welcoming time in our country's history. Little did we know what was coming, but... And so Jackie shared with me that she had, you know, just had sensed that these young professionals had been so displaced. So we started, this was the networking thing that I started in my home, which was basically to get people to come together and just know that there were a lot of people that were wanting to connect. And it's really just, it has been amazing because all of these young women, and now we have a young men of color organization, which actually started before this, they have built these networks of people inside of the company that even peers of theirs have yet to build, because, you know, you kind of come in and you're a new employee and you're like 22 years old or 24 years old right out of grad school, and you're just kind of like heads down, who do I talk to? I don't even know where the cafeteria is. Am I supposed to go to the bathroom during the day, or am I supposed to stay at my desk the whole time? And so it's just been like, it's been awesome to see how the connections can work so fast, independent of race or gender or anything, just by sort of like putting a stimulus under, or a little catalyst under it in a few points.
Great, right. Go to the question here and then there. Yep.
Hi, I'm Caroline Coles with Hologic. We make mammography equipment. So I think we have two really untapped markets. We have a lot of females that work at Hologic, And we have the primary user of our equipment, our female technologists. So you talked in the beginning about using more external networks for innovation.
Yeah.
How do you start to approach that within an organization?
How do you start to approach it by leveraging internal networks or just in general?
Just in general.
Yeah. So
outside of like an R&D, you know, focus group.
Example. So one of the most, you need two key things. One is a win-win mutual benefit design, right? So there has to be a reason why two different networks would want to come together. And then you need a collaborative process for people to actually get together and talk and turn ideas into action. So if you think about the Oreo example, it was not only a team that had been designed, but that had practiced collaborating together and launching real-time ads. So the first thing I do is think about what are two, you know, within your company, what are external networks where there's a mutual benefit, where they could learn and gain insights, and you also could gain those insights. And then secondly, how could you run some rapid experiments, so not something that would take 6 months, but maybe 2 days, to figure out what's the collaborative process that you could work on and a few tangible projects that would help you get to that next step. Great. We're over. We're almost time. I think we're almost out of time. Thank you so much. I want to give a round of applause for Jen and Christine. Thank you for coming, and we hope you continue to get big things done.